sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Bad news is good news for the markets. Best week for China stocks in years. And major oil companies' ratings are cut by the S&P. All this and much more on episode number 432 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, how are you? Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're into October of 2015. The final quarter of the year is now upon us, where the hope for fourth quarter magic, an end of year rally that can take the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, and the Dow into positive territory somehow. Already we're seeing that there was a nice spike. We're going to talk about that as the end of the week approached. Going to give you a quick update on the week that was. Some of the things that are happening in terms of important economics in the future, as well as some overview of the more important details and items that hit the news this week. Quick note that I was on Frank Curzio's Wall Street Unplugged podcast this week. I was his guest. The link will be on the Disciplined Investor website on the show notes. Or you can just head over right to frankcurzio.com or just look him up on Google or whatever you want to do. Look up Wall Street Unplugged. You'll find that podcast there. We talked about a lot of good topics. Matter of fact, we talked about some of the things that were kind of surprising about the Fed. We talked about stocks. We talked about some of the domestic and international issues that are out there. Just kind of made the rounds across all of the different and more important features. Great time with Frank. Always good to be on his show because he's a great, he brings on great guests. I'll put myself aside here for a second, but his show brings on great guests and a tremendous amount of information that is available through him. One of my favorite shows out there. And I know a favorite of many of yours. Well, let's go through what happened during the week. I guess I might as well start with the jobs report. Pretty bad, especially when we looked at the revisions. Did you note that at all? The revisions were really ugly. There was nothing in this report that was, I don't think you could see as positive. The news of what actually occurred during the month, the limited amount of new people on the payrolls, 142,000, even though the unemployment rate was still at 5.1%, expecting about 200,000. So I just don't see that there's anything good about that. And then you add to the fact that there was also revisions lower to both August and July. August payrolls were revised down by about 37,000 to about $136,000. This is a time when August payrolls, we know that seasonally, tend to have large upward revisions. So something is not sitting right. July payrolls were revised down to about 223,000. All in all, the last 2 months, we saw revisions of about 59,000 come off. Now, meanwhile, we saw that the unemployment rate stayed at 5.1%. Well, that's because the labor participation rate was down to a 38-year low. So the stability in the unemployment rate was the result of this rather impressive decline in the labor force participation rate. And how'd you get there? Well, essentially, the labor force declined by 350,000 people. So the participation rate went down to 62.4 from 62.6. Now, so if you did a calculation and you looked at the labor force participation rate remaining the same as it was the month before, the unemployment would have actually pushed up to 5.3%. Now, I know that there's been a lot of talk about ignoring the labor participation rate, but a lot of people have become vastly discouraged and left the labor force, and that is keeping the unemployment rate at 5.1. Now, I wonder if what happened on Friday, this big reversal that we saw in markets, was because there was a realization that there was this kind of rough number and revisions, and you add that to the fact that the labor participation rate was down and all the people that left the labor force, and the fact that the Fed is watching this and monitoring this very closely, and the realization was, there's no way the Fed can raise rates at this point. So that average hourly earnings were flat. And also, of course, big layoffs, right? We saw that Hewlett Packard and a few other names were doing some big layoffs. So one of the things that I mentioned on Twitter last week was that there was a pretty good possibility of a disappointment that was going to be coming soon in terms of the employment numbers. Because if you think about what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, months, we've seen that the manufacturing numbers have been starting to really slow. We're not in contraction on the ISM yet, but we're really close, right? We're at 50.2. But we saw the manufacturing and factory orders numbers really slowing considerably in all major districts, with the exception of Dallas, Milwaukee, Philly, the Empire. These all are showing really ugly numbers, missing by a wide margin. And when you see that manufacturing and factory orders are starting to slow down as much as they are, you have to say to yourself, wait a minute, how can unemployment stay really in good shape if in fact manufacturing is not doing well? Well, you can have construction doing well. You can have maybe the service index industry really hiring a lot. But you know what? Really, when you see the global environment as it is today, slowing down appreciably almost everywhere, and then you see that the manufacturing is starting to slip here, you have to realize that probably something's got to give. Something, you can't have all of it. You can't have manufacturing sliding. You can't have the globe and the world at large in terms of economics slowing down and think that we are going to just stay out of the loop, you know, untouched. I think a lot of people are thinking that. Something's gonna have to give. And it had been manufacturing for some time. And now we're seeing that that is slipping over into the jobs numbers. One of the things that's really interesting is that even with all of the global woes and concerns and wars and economic issues in China, and just add them all up, consumer confidence that came out last week was much higher than anticipated. I think it came in at 103. Expectations were for about 97, I think. And I thought it was really interesting that this is when we're seeing that wage growth is flat. We're seeing that spending is kind of flat. We're seeing that generally, you know, the University of Michigan confidence numbers really took a dive. And again, with all the things that are out there that could concern consumers, somehow magically, the Commerce Department comes out with a report that shows how happy people are. Usually you would have that if hiring was really good, this is stability in the overall economy. And on top of that, wage growth, that makes people really happy, right? Wage growth is a major driver of happiness, because if you have wage growth, what you have is the opportunity to potentially even spend or save more. So there's a disconnect. Somewhere there's a disconnect. And I think that we're finally starting to see a little bit of that flow into the jobs numbers. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to start to see massive layoffs like we saw back in, you know, the last time around here. But, you know, with all of the problems in the oil patch, with all the problems that we're seeing around the world, with all the issues with slowing manufacturing, factory orders, et cetera, I mean, okay, and the big layoffs that we're seeing from some companies, you have to realize that that's going to happen. So what does it mean? What does it mean that we're seeing that this employment is slowing down finally, and we're seeing that manufacturing is in tandem moving in the same direction, but consumer confidence, on the other hand, is good? I think the reality is that The major overlay in this is that the Fed cannot raise interest rates for some time. Now, if they go down the route of saying, hey, we're raising interest rates because we said we're going to raise interest rates, that's going to blow all the confidence in them that they had. Already they've been flip-flopping around, as we talked about the last few weeks. So what's going to happen? And why is this possibly maybe good in the short term for stocks, bad in the long term because of the stocks and the economy may move together? Clearly, there's a slowdown that's apparent. It's not too bad at this point. It's just starting to show up. Probably because of the high U.S. dollar, the rally that we've seen. The world economic is slowdown that is taking effect and playing out here, as well as the fact that obviously many of our exporting companies are not able to make the profits that they had before. We're seeing that in not only earnings, but we're seeing that in their outlook and guidance. Stocks in the interim or possibly sporadically may look at this as hope that the Fed is going to step in, maybe with more quantitative easing. If nothing else, maybe just simply not raising rates for some time. That would be negative on the dollar. Now, recently, there's been a very high correlation of the dollar and stocks. When the dollar moves higher, generally speaking, stocks are moving higher and vice versa. But the big question is, will that continue? Bonds also like this, as again, they're hoping for the Fed to step in and to work their magic. But the problem is, we do know, we have statistical evidence and empirical evidence that each and every stimulus that the Fed has done since the 2008 has been fallout and basically implosion of the financial system has been less and less effective. The other problem you may have with all this going on right now and the uncertainty about the Fed and the U.S. economy, the rest of the world's not going to be too happy. Yeah, you may see a little spurt in stocks because we had this great reversal. I mean, we're talking about a technical bounce that I saw where pre-market futures dropped about 30 points on the S&P from where they were overnight. The Dow futures dropped like 250 points from the high overnight. U.S. dollar dropped hard against the yen and the euro. Then throughout the day, steadily recovered, all of them. But the world itself, if you have a dollar down, you look at Europe and Japan as two major casualties of a lower dollar, it's really not good for them. One of the things that was probably, I think, very telling on Friday, although we'll see where this plays out, but the most shorted names from a list that Goldman Sachs monitors in the market were the best performers of the day. And usually that's not the best sign. You'd rather see some of the major names making, you know, major strides. You'd rather see the leaders resuming their leadership. But when you have the most shorted stocks that are actually making a major runaway, you realize that's a short squeeze. And sometimes what happens is with those, it's a forced squeeze and they end up getting shorted again and it doesn't really bode well for markets. Banks were flat on the day on Friday, even though it was a nice move up, because there was a lot of bets in for a steepening yield curve if, in fact, the employment number was good. If the economy moves along and cruises at a nice level of GDP, which is now being adjusted down for the next quarter, by the way, down to about 1.5%. And now we have the hurricane, the storm. I think it's Jacqueline or Joaquin or somebody. I was supposed to be actually in New York and Montauk fishing over the weekend, but due to the storm with 15-foot seas in Montauk, I couldn't go. Kind of bummed. Great striper run this time of year. Anyway, so the most shorted names were the ones that were really seeing the most activity, and that is a bit concerning when we think about how markets do react on, you know, they have no memory. And with the recent moves that we've seen and the volatility with the 300-point days, which again, a Friday was another 300-point day from peak to trough in the Dow Jones, or very close to it, that's an area that's of big concern. So we do still see that the NASDAQ, the S&P, NASDAQ slightly down for the year. The S&P and the Dow are squarely in the red. One of the other things that really was very pronounced last week that I think we need to talk about. I really do. I think this is something that is time to spend a little bit of breath on, because if you really understand the underlying mechanism of how markets work and how risk is played with when it comes to financial assets, we need to really understand that underneath a lot of this is that has in fact been a driver, both on the up and the down, in major financial expansions and contractions will be credit. The ability to get credit individually or corporately, and these days on a sovereign nature with governments, but the ability to expand your credit in order to lever up and to utilize that credit in order to, whether it's to buy something, whether it's to expand a business, whether it's to do clean up the other credit when you have lower interest rates now. So you go out and you actually look to take your current bonds that you have as a company that maybe are at 5%. You restructure them and you buy them and you close them out, and you maybe can refinance those at 3%. Saves a lot of money. Anyway, this expansion of credit that we've seen because there is an appetite, a massive appetite around the world for yield, because you can't get yield anywhere. So anytime there is the opportunity to grab some of it, especially for an elongated period of time, investors have done so. And that's why there was such an incredible rise in the junk bonds, the lower grade bonds over the years, and why Carl Icahn is screaming at the top of his lungs that, you know, there's something wrong. That, in fact, there is the underlying risk of below grade debt, where companies who have an excessive amount of debt or even a reasonable amount of debt may get into trouble and have a problem servicing that debt. And this really came to the front last week with a company called Glencore. Glencore is it's a commodity-related company. And if we know what's gone on in the world of commodities over the last 3 years, whereas prices have gone directly down, and recently this year where they basically collapsed due to a lot of factors like China's lack of importing and stockpiling, slower growth around the world, etc., and the dollar moving higher, which of course does in fact hurt currencies. There's a lot of companies that are in bad shape. And one of the things that happened last week, at the beginning of last week, was that a note came out about the concern about Glencore's inability to pay upcoming debt potentially. They have a load of debt that needs to be, that's maturing, and they need to pay that off. And the question is, usually what happens is when debt is paid off, if there's not enough cash around, let's say, to pay it off and retain a lot of money on your balance sheet, one of the things that happens is that they'll renew the debt. They'll do an offering. But the question is, at what price and who wants it? The price is a function of supply and demand. And you may get into a situation where you have to issue debt at a much higher rate than you did previously, or that you want to, or that you can afford. So Glencore's debt came into question, and the stock sold off by about 27%, took commodity-related companies down as well. And then the company came out throughout the week reassuring investors, talking about how they have plenty of money to pay off their debts and run their operations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. By the end of the week, actually, Glencore was closed pretty much unchanged from where it began the week before. But really what we're talking about here is the whole environment that we are in, where companies, particularly in materials and commodities related areas, have done an incredible job at levering themselves to a point that they're choking on their own debt. And if this continues, you're going to see what Carl Icahn is really concerned about, a domino effect in the below grade junk bond area, or the below investment grade debt area, where all of a sudden there's going to be a lockout from the access to more funding and the ability for them to actually renew their debt that they need to for companies that have debt coming in the immediate future, especially if there's a block of it that is oversized compared to the rest of their debt. They didn't somehow, they were not able to stagger it appropriately, or they're just levered in a way that maybe now with the price of oil, with the price of commodities, copper, or other materials, platinum, zinc, whatever it is, that investors are very concerned about actually lending money to them at a reasonable rate. And what happens then is that they will have to pay a lot more money when their debt rolls. And as they have to pay a lot more money as their debt rolls, the problem is that they're not taking in as much money from their commodity-driven business. Revenues are down, they're shutting mines, et cetera. And therefore, their debt payment ratios are really out of whack. Once again, pushing up the price that they will need to pay to people in terms of interest. So people aren't going to pony up as much money to pay for a bond that maybe has some, a company that has some problems with their debt payments, or could be seen as a company that will have problems with their debt payments. The longer that we go with commodities and oil, et cetera, having their price rock bottom or lower, the worse it becomes. Because what's built in right now is the idea that this is all transitory, right? It's all temporary. It's just, you know, it's going to be here for a couple of years, maybe. And then it's just, everything's going back to normal. But the longer that these companies are sitting with commodity prices very low, their margins are very lean, and they have less money coming in to pad those income payments, the debt structure, debt financing that they need to do, debt servicing, the worse it becomes. They keep on leaking money, and there's no sign that anything's going to change. Investors become very leery. Ratings go down. As a matter of fact, we saw late Friday, after the close of the market, that that S&P Standard & Poor's taking action on some companies that could be long overdue. We saw that Exxon, a number of companies, but just two that stuck out were Exxon and Chevron, were among several of the companies that had their outlooks or their ratings cut by the S&P 500 by the S&P rating service. It's kind of interesting, right? You know, these are companies that these are big boys. But because of the struggle they've had to keep their revenues flowing and their net income or earnings high, they've had a tough ride. And it's showing up now in the concern from S&P for their bond ratings. And it's just what we're talking about here, the ability for them to pay back their debt, pay the income and the principal upon maturity. So with that, this is, again, more fuel to the fire back to the less attractive bonds of the past that have been bid up to a point because to a point that, that is actually ridiculous because the spread between, let's call it, AAA corporates, AA corporates, and B-rated bonds is very narrow compared to where it was many years ago when risk was taken into account and when yields you can get a decent yield on, let's say, a AA or an A-rated bond on a corporate basis. And the reason has been, as I mentioned, is that pension funds, individuals, and all sorts of other investors are running for yield. They need to get yield from bonds, and they just can't get it. So what they're doing is going down the list and down the ratings further and further to grab the yield. So we'll have to see how this plays out, but I would watch, for example, JNK. It's a junk bond ETF. Watch HYG, another lower grade a bond ETF. And we've seen the last, I don't know, let's say year to date, they're down 5-6%. Not terrible, but still something that needs to be watched because if there is a break, as Mr. Icahn is talking about, at any level, there's very little liquidity in this area compared to, let's say, equities or treasuries or, you know, high grades. Something to definitely keep an eye on. Now, as we're talking about some of the areas that have been really hit hard. We got to talk about the biotech sector. I mean, wow. Biotech sector for the last, about 3 weeks now has been an absolute disaster. Let me give you a little bit of background on this and why this occurred and maybe some clarity on this. But this started about 3 weeks ago when, first of all, markets got a little bit antsy on a lot of things, but biotechs are still holding up. They still thought that, hey, you know what? We have an aging population here and abroad, a lot more breakthroughs, a lot more opportunity. Biotechs have been really doing great in terms of their earnings. Their outlook was excellent. The pipeline was good. So they were holding up, but all of a sudden, things turned. And if you remember, this is when this guy, Martin Shkreli, he's the CEO of Turing Pharmaceutical. Real jerk, in my opinion, the way he handled this. But he raised his price of one pill, an old medication that was for some bacterial infection that was around for years. I mean, decades. This is a guy who bought the company. He was an ex-hedge fund manager, bought this company, came in and took this one pill for this drug from $13.50 to $750 per pill overnight, about a 5,000% increase. And that's what really looks like it initiated the whole Hillary thing, where she tweeted that she was preparing to propose and to bring out some kind of a plan to stop this and limit exposure to individuals to about $250 per month out of pocket for prescription drugs, and how this was price gouging, et cetera. And this guy just, he was just really, the way he handled this, he was nasty and stupid in my opinion, but that's another story. He could have handled it better and maybe it wouldn't have blown back into the entire sector as it has. But since then, we saw initially a drop, and then it just kept on getting hammered day in and day out, where the biotech sector ended up being in a bear market correction, down 20-something percent in a matter of weeks. If you look at the symbol IBB, it's the NASDAQ Biotech Index, and it was obliterated. It didn't really matter what company you were. It was just being sold. We actually picked up some of it this week, I believe it was, the biotech sector, and we added to it each and every drop, and it turned out to be a pretty good move so far, because things have really got out of hand in terms of the selling. It was almost a panic sell, throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of move that we saw on this. But now research has been coming out since then, a lot of research, matter of fact, chunks of research and things about practices by pharmaceutical and biotech companies. And specifically, it's talking about their practices in the area of drug pricing. And so, this one situation that was brought up, and Hillary Clinton's tweet, and then her plan or proposal or campaign promise that she brought forth, which I don't know how that's exactly going to work, because who's going to pay the rest, and how's this, you're going to put some constraints on the biotech companies, because if you do that, one of the problems is that you start to stifle innovation. I think we talked about this a little bit. I know we talked about it on DH Unplugged, but you don't want to start stifling innovation in areas that are life sustaining. I mean, it's one thing if you want to clamp down on, there's 100 different things you could think of, some kind of bad food practice, and, because maybe they're raising prices on food, et cetera, you kind of cut back on that. But we're talking about drugs here that may be those drugs that are life-saving. It starts to stifle innovation in that area. You really are doing a disservice to all humanity, frankly. But some of the things that are coming out are very disturbing. For example, when you look at Pfizer, there's a report that came out that while price raises on various products over the years are normal, of course, they raised their prices on 133 of their brand name drugs this year. Merck did 38. Now, to put that in perspective, Pfizer's increase over the years on drugs, the various drugs that they've increased that they currently had as in their arsenal, and they just raised the prices on, helped add over $1 billion in quarterly revenue from mid-2012. Bristol-Myers added about $435 million. Now, that's just from the increase. That's not from new drugs, new pipeline, new avenues of selling. None of that. It's just from the increases in prices that they have on their current book. And some of the prices of some of these drugs have gone up 30 and 40% just this year. Now they blame it on competition, whatever that means. Because if you blame it on competition, usually you have lower prices, right? Competitive environment, you lower your prices. But no. They blame it on certain distribution channels. They come up with these ridiculous arguments. One of the things that we all know is that oftentimes these drug companies will price drugs in certain countries at one price and in other country another and another country another. And this is because countries have oversight on the drug and they have certain price levels that they'll allow. We don't have that here necessarily. I don't know if we're going to go that direction. And we do know that many of our companies here are the leaders in all sorts of research and findings in the area of biotechnology or, you know, the continuation of drugs that already have been found that have been very, I mean, we talk about how just this last couple of years, hepatitis C has been eradicated. Well, that's, you know, from a U.S.-based company, right? But I think that this is a very difficult area, and that if we think that either Hillary Clinton's her proposal or her campaign promise or Congress looking into some of this is going to really turn out to be anything more than a slap on the wrist for the time being. Even though I do agree that some of the price gouging that is going on is egregious. Companies are going to have a better look at what they're doing. No question about that. The marketing practices that they have, the spend that they have in relation to their research and distribution, et cetera, is going to have to be regulated. I don't know about you, but I am sick of these Humira commercials and, you watch CNN, it's health related commercials throughout the entire time. It's almost impossible to watch it. And these commercials are not short. They're extremely long. Enough of the Cialis commercials and Viagra and, you know, you just go on the list of Lipitor and all the different drugs that are being advertised. The last couple of 3 years has been off the rails. The amount of money that's being spent on advertising is something that will be looked at. Now that may hurt. That may actually hurt media companies. That may hurt the networks that are making the money on advertising. It may actually benefit some of these companies because they won't have to spend as much. But they'll find other ways. They'll sponsor tennis tournaments or they'll put their name on the side of a football field or who knows. Maybe even sponsor a basketball jersey. That'd be kind of cool. Put Viagra on the side of a basketball jersey or a Cialis hat and shirt on a golf tournament. I don't think that would fly too well. But, that's something that you're going to have to really pay attention to because I think there are companies that have a good amount. For example, one of the ones that the Congress is looking into right now because they're the one that seems to have the most advertising spend with the least amount of research cost. So that ratio of, all right, how much are you advertising, how much are you marketing, and what is your company really doing, and how, if in fact we believe that the cost of these drugs have to be higher because of the research costs are going up and you're coming up with all these great breakthroughs, okay, we can live with that. But a company like Valeant, which is said to be nothing more than a marketing machine, that company doesn't really do much in the way of itself doing much research and breakthroughs, just goes by other companies and takes their drugs, raises the price, markets the hell out of them, which is capitalism at its best, right? But that's the kind of things that probably you're going to see Congress looking into more so. So there's advertising to research ratio. And that's something I think is reasonable, right? I mean, that's not unreasonable. If the company is in fact going and just simply buying another company and just blanketly raising prices for profitability, it's good for shareholders, but is it good for the rest of us? And you know, you're talking about a much different situation than a consolidation of other areas. These are life-sustaining and sometimes required medicines that people have to have or else they're going to die. And to start playing with price on that is kind of rude. So take a look at the biotechs. I do think there still are, and I mentioned many of those in Frank's podcast, many of the names that I was looking at, but I think that you'll, you know, if you start to nibble into this area, particularly if you want to go into an ETF that has a broad base of, you know, hundreds of stocks in it, the NASDAQ IBB is a single-time ETF that mirrors the NASDAQ Biotech Index. It's weighted heavily in terms of some of the top players, Celgene's, Biogen, Regeneron, Amgen. But this could be something that this 20% correction that we recently saw, which it was due for some definite and definitive correction in a market that was down significantly. And on top of it, of course, there was a lot of sentiment that was lost. You're going to see continued volatility in this area, I think, as the news happens, but also because there was a lot of players that had an excessive amount of exposure to this area because it has been on such a tear for so long and may think about, hey, you know, some of these rises that we're going to see in the near future maybe are opportunities to sell and take some of the profits. But realize that I still think there's a real good opportunity with these companies, and they're really solid long-term, not all of them. But unless Congress does something very stupid, which is very possible, by the way, and they do it quickly, which is pretty impossible, by the way, then we have a lot to worry about. But otherwise, I would just think that this is an area that was overdone to the downside here and may be showing some signs of some bottoming. Now, I want to mention that also, I put a lot of charts on the disciplineinvestor.com over on this episode's show notes for the economic data that we discussed, talking about the ISM, talking about the labor participation rate, as well as the unemployment rate, et cetera. I put a lot of charts on this episode's show notes, so make sure to go over to the disciplineinvestor.com and check it out. And of course, I'll mention that you can follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is a Twitter handle. So I want to make sure that you keep in touch. Of course, you could write me a note at any time. Send me an email at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Okay, what else we got going on here? I got a long list of things that I had. Seems I checked off a good chunk of these. All right, coming up this week, I want to mention that in terms of economics, we have the ISM service sector PMI on Monday. And then we also have the Container Store coming out, Pepsi-Cola and Yum Brands. We're reporting earnings on Tuesday. Monsanto and Constellation Brands on Wednesday. And we got the minutes. The Federal Reserve March doesn't end. The minutes from the Federal Reserve September policy meeting we're going to see on Thursday. And of course, we have jobless claims coming in as well on Thursday. And the big news is that we have earnings season starting this upcoming Thursday with Alcoa. You're going to see Alcoa, Domino's, Pizza, and Ruby Tuesday. But Alcoa is the official quarter. Well, it has been for years. The official marker for the beginning of earnings season. And they're going to be coming out with their earnings, and a lot of negativity built into that number. So we'll see how that plays out. It's usually without COVID, it seems that when the earnings come out, everybody gets really excited. And then a few days later, the whole thing subsides and stock goes lower. I don't know if that's going to be the case this time. You know, you would think that we should be getting to a point of bottoming here sometime soon for some of these commodity companies with the reality that they realize that, hey, you know what? Things are bad. Cut some jobs, close some mines, close some facilities. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. But that does start the official earnings season. Now, one of the things about earnings season that's going to be interesting to watch this particular time around is going to be how companies are doing in terms of a few things. But clearly, number one, the commentary about the U.S. dollar and the global economy is going to be key in any conference call. The second thing that I think is going to be important is going to be margins. The reality is we've heard from Ebola to storms, now to the dollar, you know, the currency constant numbers that we're seeing, which is malarkey, by the way. But we're going to have to see how companies are really faring in terms of the headwinds that they're seeing from a higher cost of things related to the U.S. dollar, but also the input costs that they have going into the production and manufacturing process or whatever it is that they sell. So I think it's going to be very, very important, as it always is, but more so this quarter, because I think that investors are really keyed up right now to listen into, are companies able to increase or at least stabilize their revenue that they've had since a year ago? Because we're seeing a consistent slowdown in revenue. And, you know, with my discussion about something's got to give that I had earlier about manufacturing on one side and employment on the other, eventually one side has to give. Can't have both. Can't have, you just can't have revenues going down consistently and earnings stable. Even with all the share buybacks, there's a point. There's just a point where it can't continue. And when that happens, companies will have problems. There's no question about this. Companies will have problems with keeping pace with, you know, their earnings. And then what eventually does happen, usually the first thing after all the financial engineering that may occur and after maybe they shut down facilities, they will start to lay off people. I don't know if that's going to happen this time around. I'm just telling you, that's the sequence. Now, this quarter, I think that there's going to be a lot of antennas raised and there's going to be a lot of scrutiny put on much of the earnings, because the realization has been that, you know, this buyback craze that has gone on eventually is going to stop as rates move higher, or at least, you know, to a point that companies have exhausted a lot of their cash from a buyback standpoint and maybe issued as much debt as they can to buy back shares, et cetera. I mean, you're going to see that, you know, that whole ability for companies to buy back shares and increase their earnings are going to be maybe slow. But secondly, they're being scrutinized. Look at what's gone on with IBM. For a long time, investors allowed IBM to coast on the fact that, you know, earnings are coming, stabilizing or staying where they are, but revenues have fallen. Okay, it's okay. There's a time, though, I'm telling you, that something's got to give, that investors won't put up with it anymore. They, you know, they'll deal with something for a quarter here, a quarter there, like this whole U.S. dollar issue that initially was, oh, it's transitory, don't worry about it. Or when oil first started coming down and everybody was not concerned too much about it because they felt that, hey, the oil companies and any of the companies related to crude oil or drilling or fracking, hey, don't worry about it. It's only going to be a couple of months here or there. But then the realization hits when you have more than a quarter or two of the same story. And if, in fact, companies are going to come out with the same story again about the dollar and, you know, the fact that the dollar hurt it, but, well, dollar strength may be here to stay. So the transitory issues become much more permanent. They become much more like, okay, well, that was the transitory issue. Now it's a permanent issue. What else do we have to price in? And that's, I think, where we are this quarter. Because if, in fact, the Fed doesn't raise this year, but they do, in fact, raise next year, I think that, you know, all of this nonsense about looking at earnings that are just stable and much of it due to buybacks, et cetera, it's going to come to a fore eventually, and people are just not going to really respect that anymore. It's just the way it goes. Investor sentiment switches and moves very, very quickly. Now, a quarter or two or three or four may not be that quickly, but generally speaking, when it moves, you know, when things change, you know, it's a big concern. And the second thing is, what is the outlook? Companies came out last quarter, were very concerned about the outlook for the dollar. Now we got some weather issues. We got war. We got commodity prices. Maybe we have consumer spending that hasn't really been keeping up. There's a lot of things that could really throw a monkey wrench into the guidance more so than it did last quarter. And if companies come out with the same guidance that they had, the same commentary and storyline that they did last quarter, that's where the concern comes in. So I think that maybe some of the recent drop in markets and the distribution that we saw was due to an advancement of the potential for a lot of concern. Now, we do see this, by the way, a lot of times into earnings season. If you take a chart and you look at it, and you look at the month or so before earnings season, people are very concerned. And then earnings season comes and, not so bad. And they pile things higher. So you may also see that kind of situation only to be a short reprieve if earnings aren't great, but they're okay. If the worst is not realized, therefore, people say, well, they're oversold at this point. You know, valuations are reasonable considering all things. So you get that kind of movement back and forth in terms of, okay, it's going to be maybe really bad, and then it's not so bad. So, okay, well, that's good. Then it's not so bad. Then we'll buy in. Or the opposite. We expect things to be really great, really great, and then they disappoint, right? That could be a real problem too. Meeting expectations is always reasonably good, but so many times analysts are far off the mark, economists too, when it comes to their forecasts. The Fed's already and the world is already dropping down estimates for global growth. Well, wait a minute. You made estimates and you're wrong. That's what you're telling us. You were wrong. And they're wrong so much of the time. It's very difficult to predict anything out, even a quarter, but a quarter you could do it because you could see what's happening from the past and what goes into the process, whether it's economics or earnings. And companies can do that. But going much further out than that's almost impossible because you don't know what's going to happen. The uncertainty of what is out there doesn't have to be scary, but at the same time, you don't know what it's going to be. Unless you're a company that knows your orders, like a Nike knows to an extent of what their orders are moving forward for a very long period of time. At least they tell us that. Then, you know, I think that one quarter of outlook is reasonable. Don't ever look at something further. When the Fed is putting out their outlook for 2017 for interest rates, what their expectations are, I mean, those are going to be adjusted. One way or the other, it could be higher or lower, but they're going to be adjusted because they've not been right for the longest time. They're terrible in terms of their record. Economists, generally speaking, I would say it's a shot in the dark. I mean, every economist missed this particular month's employment number. I mean, even the worst case was not as low as what came out. And I don't think there was any surprises here. I mean, really, there was nothing that I could really point to that said, well, let's think. Was there anything that was really that people didn't know? No, we saw that the manufacturing hiring was awful. We saw that the fact is that there was while there was a consistent initial claims that were very, very low, meaning that people were not being fired, you know, the reality is, you know, the unemployment rate is relatively at a point with the participation rate that is full employment for this, what I consider this time period. I don't think it's, you know, we're not going to get into the 4.2s again. I'd be very surprised, unless the unemployment rate goes really low. The participation rate goes really low. So I think that, you know, you have to take economist numbers with a grain of salt as a general path. Because really, when you're looking at consensus, what is it? It's just the average from the high to the low. You know, that's all it is. So it would be better to look at the range if they gave us ranges, which you can look at, of course, if you look at the high and the low and the analysts before any economic number comes out. But just realize that much of the same thing goes on with earnings. And while companies do a good job to telegraph information about earnings to analysts, they're usually not so great when it comes to companies other than the, you know, Dow type of companies, because those companies, you know, have been around for a long time and they're consistent. And unless something really weird happens, you know, they kind of know what's going to happen with their earnings, generally speaking, from this quarter to the next quarter, or at least for the next month or so when they are telegraphing information to analysts about expectations as they're building their models, et cetera. So anyway, we're going to wrap it there. We were supposed to have a guest that canceled, actually. I apologize for that. Maybe we'll get him back. Maybe we won't because he canceled. But check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com, Aero Strategy, of course, and the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. All those are available. Information is available on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you want to reach out to me, you want to check those out, it may be high time to take a look at diversifying your portfolio. Maybe you're not happy with just being long, being out, just being in a traditional asset allocation. I don't know. Maybe you want to take a look at what we're doing here. Particularly looking at a real good diversifier because it diversifies you in a lot of different ways in terms of the trading style and being short, being long is the Aero strategy. Go long the S&P, short the S&P, or neutral. Out. It's an algorithmic strategy that we utilize, that we've designed. And if you want information on that, just, again, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and just request that information. We'll send it right off to you because I do not know who you are magically. You're listening right now. You can hear me. I can't hear you listening to me. I don't know who you are. So if you want information, make sure to go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.